Good evening, good morning, welcome. This is the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. Thank you very much for joining me. We've got a granddaddy of twisted conspiracy to talk about tonight. A book so interesting, a story so bizarre. George Norrie has covered this. George Knapp, I believe Ian has talked about this book and has done interviews in the past. Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and a Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. Edward T. Haslam is our guest this evening. His book is re-released with more information. Edward, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
I want to know real quickly, I mean, this is a 60-year-old cold case.
50.
Well, 50-year-old cold case. I apologize. A 50-year-old cold case. Why is it still so relevant today that we should continue to educate and learn about this story?
First of all, we have a cancer epidemic today, which has its roots back in the 1950s, and decisions that were made and involving cancer-causing monkey viruses that this woman was involved with. And I look at this case, I mean, we call it the hottest cold case in America, but I look at it as like Walt Whitman's Blade of Grass, that if you understand this case, you'll understand what was going on in the entire country in the 50s and 60s, and all that stuff affects our health crisis that we're having today. So this is really pulling up the plant, looking at the roots.
And I understand that, and we're going to get into the story on here. I wanted to ask a few other questions here to start it to be a little different than what you've experienced with the hosts in the past on here. But when we talk about the epidemic of cancer, can't we also look at that since the 1950s, we've gone away from natural sweeteners, natural foods. We've gone to GMOs. We've gone to saccharins, artificial sweeteners, things that we know are also cancer-causing. It seems that we have microwave technology around us. We've got cell phone technology, which they're still on the fence post about saying, you know, some are saying that it's causing cancer and creating it. Others are saying the microwave technology, so much of what's going on. Can't a lot of what we're dealing with in the world right now with cancer-causing agents, can't it also be linked to much of what we've done to ourselves by accepting these modifications to our food?
Well, that's a great question. One of the ways you catch these people is they overplay their parts, okay? So I have a document from the American Cancer Society about 200 possible causes of cancer, and the word virus is not in there. Now, that's strange because they knew back in the 50s that cancers could be caused by viruses. And now today they're out there marketing the human papillomavirus vaccine, which is a vaccine against a cancer-causing virus. So they can no longer, since they're marketing it, they can no longer admit it. What you see when you look at the numbers, you go to the National Cancer Institute and you get the numbers, and you look at them and you see that there is a epidemic of soft tissue cancers that erupts after the polio vaccine. And that we're talking about breast, prostate, melanoma, and lymphoma. And there's also childhood brain cancer in there. I didn't include that in the list for some technical reasons about when the thing starts. That starts actually right after the polio vaccine. But I think they have omitted the conversation. When I started talking about cancer-causing viruses back in 1995, I was way out on a limb by myself. And everyone was talking about all the other environmental things. But the fact is that they discovered the most carcinogenic entity ever discovered, which was SV40. And they discovered that was in the polio vaccine after they had released 100 million doses of it.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We've got a long show ahead of us, folks. This is a twisted tale that, if it's true, folks, this is truly one of the most terrifying things on the planet. that we're subjected to this. We'll find out more. Edward Haslam, we'll find out about our guest. We'll find out about Dr. Mary. We'll find out about how this all connects and what is the thread that weaves through this story of a doctor's unsolved murder that links to the Lee Harvey Oswald and JFK assassinations and emerging global epidemics. We've got a big show. Stay tuned. Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. DrMary'sMonkey.com. That's the site you can check out for more information and how to order the brand new autographed version of the book. It's a special offer. 50 years later, it's an amazing book and an amazing story. Edward Haslam is our guest this evening, and we're going to delve into this. Now, I want to go back real quickly and learn, more importantly, why this was such an important story for you to tell. What is your tie to this tale to bring it out?
The doctor who was murdered is Dr. Mary Sherman. She was a professor of orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School down in New Orleans. My father was a professor of orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. So my father and Mary Sherman taught at the same medical school, the same subject, and they were good friends. So when she died, I mean, she even came out to the house. I remember as a kid sitting on her lap. I mean, I have a personal contact with this story that goes all the way back to my childhood. And when she died, it was big news in our family. And because of my father's proximity, he was even asked to go to the morgue and look at the body. I mean, I heard things at home that the public did not hear. And so for 30 years, I had these sort of latent rumors in my head, and I didn't have any documents on it. And I finally went to the library, and I got the documents, and I got the autopsy report, the police reports, and all that. And I discovered what the public was not told about this. And that was, I mean, what the public was told was that Mary Sherman was found naked in her bedroom, and she was stabbed 7 or 8 times and set on fire, and the police were all running around looking for some kind of crazed sex slashing, maybe a lesbian or something like that. And what really happened to Mary Sherman, and you can see this at the website because I posted the photo, her entire right arm and rib cage was disintegrated by heat. I mean, it's just gone. And right next to that is unburned hair. Now, hair is the easiest thing to burn on the body, and bones technically don't even burn. When they can finish a cremation, they got bones, and they grind them up and give you back bone dust. And so the question was, what burned off Mary Sherman's arm? And there's the toaster. I mean, there's nothing in the apartment that could have possibly done that damage. And once you understand that point, and that point was never told to the public, okay? Once you understand that point, then you realize that whatever happened to Mary Sherman's body did not happen in her apartment. It happened somewhere else, and they brought her body back to her apartment, and they faked a murder scene. Now, that's a cover-up from the get-go. What are they covering up, and why? That is what drove me on this. And the other lead I had on this from going back into the 60s when this happened, this was 64 when her murder happened, but in 67, the district attorney, Jim Garrison, started looking into the JFK assassination and the Lee Harvey Oswald subject in New Orleans. That's the subject of Oliver Stone's JFK film. And he did an interview with Playboy magazine. And in that interview, he says his investigators had determined that Dr. Mary Sherman, the woman we're talking about, was associated with David Ferry, his primary suspect, in some kind of secret cancer research, and that there were other doctors in New Orleans involved. Well, what the public didn't know about Mary Sherman, and what I knew from my father, is who she was, okay? And Mary Sherman was a world-class doctor. She was out of the University of Chicago, and she was an expert in both cancer and radiation. She was widely published in the peer review articles of the day. She ran a cancer lab for Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, one of the big regional health clinics. And the guy she worked for, Ochsner, had been president of the American Cancer Society. So this woman is And oh, plus she was the chair of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. So she's one of the highest ranking people in American medicine. And to have her involved in an underground cancer laboratory with a political lunatic loose cannon like David Ferry is an awfully strange combination of resources. And so I'm saying, what's going on with this? Why would this highly credentialed, internationally respected doctor be involved in a secret laboratory with some defrocked priest who's had his airline license pulled? I mean, you know, that's the question. That's one of the questions that drove me on this from the beginning.
What you did know about Mary, Dr. Mary Sherman, before, though, what was she doing? What was her job, you know, in the industry? Was she well known for working with cancer patients, trying to understand what was going on with cancer? You said that she was working on a secret cancer program. But what all can you tell us about her and her personality and you know, kind of a background on her?
Well, one of the things that she's was quoted as saying in her obituary that appeared in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery was that it was important for medicine to have research connected to clinical medicine. And this idea that research is done in a laboratory and it's got nothing to do with doctors taking care of patients, she rejected that idea. She said it's got to be connected, okay? So she wrote wonderful articles. I mean, her articles are quoted for 50 years. I mean, when you get into the, you know, those books that tell you where the quotes are. And so she was a practicing doctor in an orthopedic clinic. She did surgery. Just this weekend, I was in New Orleans and for the 50th anniversary of her death, and I spoke to a woman who was actually a nurse who was in the surgery room with her. I said, you know, like, what was she like in the surgery room? And she said, this woman was definitely in charge and definitely knew what she wanted, and you better pay attention when she talked, okay? So she was a very forceful, very commanding woman who was very sophisticated. She was educated in Paris and spoke French, sang opera, and she read books, loved flowers. I mean, she was a very interesting, thorough person, and that face of her is very different than the face of David Ferry. But we have witnesses now who were in the same room with them and listened to their conversations, and she got brought into all this by her boss, Alton Ochsner, who I have his FBI file. He's got a 40-year history of secret relationships with the United States government. He worked with the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, the U.S. Public Health Service, and the FBI, and one other unnamed agency. So that's where she's coming from. She ran the bone pathology laboratory at Ochsner Clinic. So if somebody had an issue and the question was, is this cancer or not, it would be Mary Sherman that would make the call on it. And when she had people who had amputations or died from things, I mean, she would actually have, you know, their bones sliced and put into things so they could study them. I mean, she had one foot very clearly in cancer research. And in fact, the University of Texas published a book called Tumors of the Bone and Soft Tissue. And Mary was asked to write two articles for that book. And in that book, she questions the very language that is used to describe cancer. I mean, she says, I don't think this language is helpful. I mean, you call this that and that the other thing. We need to rethink what we call cancer and make sure that the language has something to do with its origins and its nature.
Your background, at what point in your life did this puzzle become something that you decided you wanted to look at, and not just, you know, from the little bits and pieces you'd heard throughout your life? I mean, was there one culminating moment that made Ed Haslam say, I need to know this story?
Yeah, I jumped out of bed in the middle of the night. landed on my feet and said, "Oh my gosh!" Back in the '60s, I had a fear that was about this underground medical laboratory that they were working on a biological weapon involving cancer-causing monkey viruses, and the question was, what happens if it escapes? Okay, so from the '60s, I sort of had one eye open for the issue of monkey viruses affecting public health. And when the AIDS epidemic started to appear on the media landscape in the 80s, the mainstream scientific community said this is a mutated monkey virus. Well, and they said it specifically, it is a mutation of SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus. You'll hear the word simian a lot in this conversation. It means monkey. It's just a medical term for monkey. But the simian immunodeficiency virus mutated. And when I heard that on one hand, and I heard a report from New Orleans that they had discovered an early AIDS case at Tulane, I said, wait a second. This is hard physical evidence that nobody's looked at. That, I mean, you got this group of people mutating monkey viruses on one hand, and you got this never seen before disease caused by a mutated monkey virus. Somebody needs to look into this. And I didn't set out to write a book. I didn't want to get involved in this. I tried to get other people. I tried to sort of wave the flag and say, look over here, guys, why don't you write about this? And I certainly didn't want to get into the JFK situation. But that's where the whole story leads, and I'm not going to go anywhere except where the truth leads on this. And
well, let me ask you about this then, because with your background, you have a different background. You're not in the medical field yourself.
That's right. My background was advertising, but I'm fairly well educated. And I know how to read, so I read a lot of medical articles.
And understand that I know by mentioning last night that you were going to be on the show, many of the people that shot me questions. We're asking, what does an advertising exec know about medical cases to look at these cases and know how to draw these conclusions and threads? I think it's important to maybe take a step back again real quickly for your validation, and that it's not like it's your advertising madman guy and have no connection to the medical field. Your father and grandfather were pretty instrumental in the medical field as well, correct?
Yes, my grandfather developed the anthrax vaccine. My father was out of Harvard. And, talk of medicine was at the dinner table every night when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up around medicine. And, I don't think you need to be a zoologist to know if there's an elephant in your living room.
Right, but it certainly helps in the credibility of you putting the story together to know that we're not just looking at a gentleman who had too much free time and trying to piece together a puzzle that may not fit. You actually have deep roots in the medical community and in the field that you can go to research and get these answers and understand this.
I've had a lot of help by doctors.
Okay? Right. And that's what I was saying is this connection is there. And there's a direct connection because you and your family knew Dr. Murray. There was that connection as well. So there's a reason that this all weaves together. And of course, who wouldn't be fascinated by hearing these stories and bits and pieces of it growing up? And when you start to piece this thing together and see this, were you blown away by the scope of this? I know you said you weren't looking for the JFK or Lee Harvey Oswald angles, but as you started to see this puzzle form, did it seem maybe you were piecing the wrong pieces together at any point? Did you ever think there's no way this can fit? There's no way there's this kind of connection going on.
The scale of this story is staggering. Okay. And when I started reading about Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, and that Bernice Eddy had taken it upon herself to go to the Cancer Society meeting in New York and tell her colleagues, her other researchers. I mean, this woman was MD, PhD, in charge of vaccine safety testing for the United States government. And she went and told the people that there was a cancer-causing virus in the cells upon which the polio vaccine was grown. She stopped short of saying we found it in the polio vaccine, but she said it's definitely in the stock. And when I realized that this woman risked her career, if not her life, to tell us that to warn us that there was going to be an epidemic of cancer as a result of this contamination of the polio vaccine. My brain was practically busting, and that's when I went and got the NCI statistics on this to see. I said, if she's correct, it ought to be in the statistics.
Okay? Well, let's take a break. Our guest this evening, Edward Haslam, Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, Emerging Global Epidemics, and More. We've got a long way to go, folks. Stay with me. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. And if you've missed any part of tonight's show, remember, become a Coast Insider. It's easy. You can sign up yourself. For just pennies a day, you can find 5 years' worth of archives of the show. You'll never miss another episode. You'll get exclusive access to guests and the hosts of Coast to Coast with special chats every month. A lot of great insider information, so go check it out. Sign up, coasttocoastam.com. And if you like the paranormal and the strange, the supernatural, then you can join me 5 nights a week, Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight, as I explore the strange and unusual on Darkness Radio. You can find that at darknessradio.com. We stream it through iHeartRadio from our home office here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you can keep dialed right in, because as soon as our show wraps up, George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange. And tonight we are talking strange. We are talking about a 50-year-old cold case of the murder, the death of a doctor, and its strange ties through our history of global emerging epidemics and links to Lee Harvey Oswald and the JFK assassination. I know this sounds so broad spectrum, so insane. How can we put all of these pieces together and see a connecting thread? That's what our journey is going to take us on tonight with our guest, Edward Haslam. And Ed, I wanted to ask you, you talked a little bit earlier about the brutal murder of Dr. Mary Sherman. You said that the report was that she was stabbed multiple times and then set on fire, but that when you look at her, things don't match up with the story of how she was killed. How do you believe she was murdered?
Well, what you look at when you see the autopsy report or the crime scene photos, which I have put in the new book. And in fact, when you go to the drmarysmonkey.com, but spell out Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R, you can see the burns to her body. And they're high voltage electrocution. Her entire right arm and rib cage are gone. You can see the internal organs of her body, her not all in the photo that I put on that one page, but in the other photos, you can see her liver, her intestines, her lungs, all that stuff. And immediately next to that is her hair and unburned skin. Now, so how do you focus heat? I mean, a cremation is 2 hours at 1600 degrees, and she was in a wood frame building and had a mattress fire. And the photos of the bedroom where she was found, the curtains are not burned. The rug's not burned. The wooden furniture is not burned. The books sitting on the nightstand are not burned. The lamp is not burned. I mean, where's the heat?
And let's ask, throw this in kind of another strange conspiracy angle. We've heard many stories of spontaneous human combustion. Very similar stories where a person sitting in a chair is burned almost from inside out, and the chair is not burned, the carpet's not scorched, drapes behind them are not affected. It's just a condensed, like a microburst, and such deep burning that, again, it seems like it would have had to have gone through some type of major laser or inferno to have the damage it was done. But how could it leave behind other pieces? She was obviously around chemicals, around different types of medical devices and things like that. Could there be any link? I mean, was there ever any research or story, you know, looked into about it being one of the cases of spontaneous human combustion that took her life?
Well, we eventually found the linear particle accelerator that burned off her arm, okay? And it was on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. And in that facility, there was a steel wall which was grounded with a heavy metal cable into the ground. The purpose of the steel wall was to protect the operators of the equipment from the radiation, because this is a high voltage radiation beam. Okay, and what in electrocutions, and I had a doctor point this out to me, a guy who had seen a lot of high voltage electrocutions, he said normally the feet come off because the electricity is traveling down the body to the ground. In Mary Sherman's case, her feet are fine. The reason is because she was standing in front of the steel wall and grabbed something with her right hand. And what happened was her entire right arm burned out like a fuse. And that's why her rib cage is gone. But the electricity, it was her right hand and she, and the right side of her body, the electricity did not cross her heart. So her heart was still beating. And so she got hit with this massive amount of electricity, but her heart was still beating. So somebody who was there with her did a mercy killing. In fact, I showed these photos to a doctor at lunch a couple weeks ago, and he looked at the photos in silence for about 15 seconds and said, somebody did her a really big favor by stabbing her in the heart, because you wouldn't want to wake up to this thing with 20% of your body gone. At any rate, and next to that, her hair is fine. And so the localized heat, I think we have a better explanation than spontaneous combustion, one that is more forensically accepted, and that is she was electrocuted by a high-voltage piece of equipment that she was working with, and that equipment was on the grounds. The linear particle accelerator was on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. I've tracked down the guy that installed the equipment. And I've talked to a number of people who've been in the building and saw the wiring there. And the equipment itself was removed shortly after her death in 64, but they left all the wiring in there. So we were able to get to the actual crime scene. I mean, that's one of the problems with this from a cold case point of view, is that the New Orleans Police Department assumed the crime scene was her bedroom. And therefore, they never really investigated the real crime scene. The real crime scene's over at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which is federal property. And I have a memo from J. Edgar Hoover that's in the new version of the book telling his agents not to investigate the murder due to jurisdiction. And when you realize that her body was moved from federal property to private property, that changed the jurisdiction from FBI to NOPD, and then the FBI could just say, hey, it's not our problem, it's not our jurisdiction. We don't have to look into this.
Edward Haslam is our guest. Dr. Mary's Monkey is the name of the book. We've got links for that book and his website up at Coast to Coast AM. Stay tuned, we've got more to discuss right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest this evening is Ed Haslam. His book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, talks about one of the most bizarre conspiracy theories I've ever heard, and a frightening one at that. We're talking about the death of Dr. Mary Sherman and the possibilities. Now, you said that you know that this is what killed her. This, and I want to throw one other weird thing at you. I mean, this took place in 1964?
Correct.
Okay. My grandmother wore so much hairspray in 1964. My mom, everybody had so much product in their hair, and they would keep it that way for 3, 4, 5 days in a row. And if anybody remembers the horrific accident that happened in the 80s when Michael Jackson was filming the Pepsi commercial and a spark caught his hair, it went up immediately.
The hair did, yes.
Right. It would seem that if she was hit with some kind of electrical current with the amount of product in a person's hair, especially at that time, that would have also worked as an accelerant. Isn't that kind of weird?
She really didn't have a lot of stuff in her hair. She wore her hair up, and it was like in a braid and pinned and stuff like that, but it was not one of those 1960s hairdos that's held in place by spray. But anyway, you can see through the pictures that her hair is not burned. Okay, all of her hair is on her head. I mean, they even burn the side of her face, but not the hair.
Right. Okay, so you've got, I was just like I said, I wanted to just throw that out there because I did think that that's strange. I know how easily hair can burn, melt, and has that effect. And I thought if it was anything like the women that I knew in the 60s, I'm surprised there's anything left on top of her head.
Well, her pubic hair is all there, and I'm sure that didn't have hairspray on it.
So this was like a concentrated flashbang almost. I mean, it hit.
Yeah, it burned out like a fuse.
Burned out, and it was just like a thump, and that was it. So whatever she was touching when that went off is what hit her. You said with a lot of certainty in your voice, Ed, that you know that this is the item that killed her. How did you put that together, that without a doubt? I mean, you could say, okay, yeah, look, there was one of these, so this very well could be. But you seem convinced that there's no shadow of a doubt that this is definitely the tool that was used to incinerate her.
Well, I am, for my own purposes, okay?
Okay.
I knew there was a linear particle accelerator in Uptown New Orleans because I was told that by a Jesuit priest who was teaching physics at the time. And he said it was on federal property and it was near Tulane. Well, this is on federal property and it's right next to Tulane's campus, okay, about a mile. And so I knew that was there. And then I had this other doctor who used to work at a cancer clinic up in the East Coast. And that cancer clinic started using linear particle accelerators to burn out tumors. And so he actually knew the guy that installed the linear particle accelerators. Okay. And that guy told him very clearly that he had gone to New Orleans and had installed a very unusual linear particle accelerator down there because it didn't have any clinical access features. It was all for some kind of vaccine research. Okay. And when we get into the backstory, which I'm very anxious to do here in a couple of minutes, about where this problem comes from, which is polio, then you will see why they're using a linear particle accelerator up there. And the whole point of this is the fact that they're trying to hide something, okay? And so you have to approach this with the mentality that you need to dig and figure out what they're trying to hide and why. And why they didn't tell the public that her arm was burned off, because they didn't want people going around Uptown New Orleans looking for a machine that could have burned off her arm. And I want to get back to this medical credibility issue for a minute, because one day I got a phone call from a doctor who said, I just read your book, and I'm in charge of programming for our annual conference, and we would like to hire you to come talk to our group. Okay, this group of 200 doctors, okay? And I accepted, okay? And so they paid me. They paid my transportation. They gave me a speaking fee. And I went up to, you know, Buffalo, New York, and talked to their group. And these guys had, like, a report card that they graded all the speakers on, okay? And they gave me, for my presentation, about, he said, I don't want you to talk to us about the conspiracy. I want you to talk to us about the medicine side of this thing, okay, which is what I focused my speech on. And I got an A from this group of 200 doctors for the presentation, which I think is pretty solid that I'm not, you know, over here in the corner smoking something. And what you learn about polio is that, we all have this vague fear of polio from the hysteria of the 1950s. But in actuality, if you exposed, you know, 1,000 people to the polio virus, 99.9% of them showed no symptoms. The polio goes in your mouth, through your intestines, and out your bottom and does not cause disease. Now, in a very small percentage of people who have some kind of problem with their intestines, maybe parasites or leaky gut or one of those things, the virus is able to get past the intestinal wall into the blood. If it gets into the blood, then it circulates throughout your body and gets up in your brainstem and starts eating your brainstem. That is what kills and cripples with polio. It's a very, very small percent of people. So the question is, where did this polio epidemic come from? When did it start? And I'm pretty sensitive to language, and I always hear it talked about as the polio epidemic of the 1950s. No, no, no. The vaccine was in the 1950s. The epidemic starts in 1943. Now, I know this because I got the numbers from the CDC, They were originally U.S. public health numbers, but the CDC has kind of taken over all that stuff, and I got it from their website. When you look at the graph, you see the polio, there were about 3,000 or 4,000 cases a year going back to the beginning of the 20th century. And then in 1942, there were 4,000 cases. In 1943, it jumps to over 10,000 cases, continues to climb up to 57,000 cases before coming back down at the end of the 1950s. So what happened in 1942 that triggered the polio epidemic? Well, that's the year they introduced antibiotics, particularly penicillin. And as I said to the doctors, and now I'll say to your audience, have you ever heard anybody ask the question, did the introduction of antibiotics trigger the polio epidemic? Because that is the question that needs to be asked. And one of the advantages that I have by not being a doctor, I mean, doctors start talking like this, and they have to look over their shoulders because somebody's going to get ready to pull their license or push them out of the organization or right. make sure they lose their practice or something. I can talk, right? I can say the things that the doctors can't say. That's one of the reasons they tell me things that I can say, all right? Now, how could antibiotics possibly trigger the polio epidemic? Well, when you take antibiotics, the reason you take them is they kill bacteria, okay? Now, but there's good bacteria and bad bacteria. I mean, bacteria is an entire kingdom, okay? Mm-hmm. And so if you've got strep or something and you take antibiotics, yes, it kills the strep, but it kills all the other stuff in your intestines that belongs there, okay, like Acidophilus, okay? And one of the things Acidophilus, which is a good bacteria, one of the things that does is it eats fungus. Now, there's funguses in your intestines, like Candida albicans, and they belong there, and they are important in the production of vitamin B12, for example, and stuff. But if you kill the Acidophilus, there's nothing to control the growth of the fungus, and the fungus starts growing. And once the fungus starts growing, it puts roots into your intestinal wall. And all of a sudden, that beautiful, selectively permeable barrier that protects you from viruses and stuff starts to erode, and things are able to get into your blood that don't belong there, which is why we have all these weird food allergies today and stuff like that. So this whole thing, and you go back and you listen to Alexander Fleming, who got the Nobel Prize for inventing penicillin, and he says, look, penicillin is a great advancement in medicine, but there's a dark side to it. You have to know the whole story with it because it's messing with your intestinal flora. And
Which is similar to the stories right now with all the antibacterial soaps, right? Right. They were saying it's kind of the same vein. We're killing all this bacteria, but now we're allowing things that should have been there protectively. We're stripping them, which is leaving us open to even more deadly and nasty things.
Yeah, and you have a balance between the bacteria and the funguses. And, you know, we're so propagandized with our language, we don't think this stuff through. I mean, like cholesterol, you know, how many times have you heard cholesterol is bad for you? Cholesterol is 100% necessary for every single cell in your body, right? Unless you know the whole story that they're only talking about a certain type of cholesterol from another animal and all that other stuff, but they just blanketly, so the word bacteria gets a bad rap because, you know, there are some bad bacteria. There's also some good bacteria. We need them. Okay, that's why people take Acidophilus. If you take antibiotics, I'm not telling you not to take them, all right? But if you take them, you need to replace the good bacteria by taking Acidophilus, Bifidophilus, all the probiotics. You can buy them in a grocery store. But make sure you do that, because if you don't, then the fungus is going to keep growing.
Right. It's just a natural way to help offset. With any medicine, any kind of treatment we get, it leaves us prone to other things. it leaves us prone to other diseases. So I can see how that could be. And when you mentioned that to the doctors, and we've got to take a break here briefly, but when you brought that up, how did the doctors respond when you pointed out that you think it may be the antibiotics that started to cause polio?
I remember one of them came up to me in tears and thanked me. That's
great
most
story.
Memorable.
Edward Haslam, our guest. We're going to continue our journey into the strange Dr. Mary's Monkey, how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing monkey viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. That comes up next on Coast to Coast AM.